Okay, so we were talking about Struve, I guess. Who were the people on the scientific staff when you came? So it was Drake?
Well, Heeshan, Drake.
Finley, Drake.
Menon. You call Findlay, he was on the scientific staff. He had
right.
the tenure
yep, yep.
track. Anyway, whether he had tenure at that time or not, I don't know. Who else? Not very many.
No, that was
a fellow named Hugh Johnson came a little bit later,
right.
I think.
Roger Lins.
Roger and Beatty. That's right. They came. Struve brought them in. That's true. And Cam Wade.
Cam Wade.
He was here already then?
Cam came same time, the same month as Struve did.
He
used to talk about that. And Frank Lowe was a little bit later, I think. Gart Westerhout was up as a visitor for a while, wasn't he? And
he used to spend summers here.
That's right. That's right. That's pretty much it, I guess. George Miley was there for a while.
No, that was later.
That much later.
Yeah.
That was much later.
That was after I came. He was postdoc.
Yeah, but the ones as I recall, when I first came. In the spring to visit the place. It was Heeshan, Drake, and Menon, I think, pretty much. That was about it at that time.
What about Groat Reber?
Reber was here, yeah.
Do you have any interactions with him? He must have been hard to deal with.
No, actually, it was sort of fun. I enjoyed just watching him function. No, when I came up in August, the regular job was on a Sunday night, I remember, and I was staying at the Hill House. They had me a room at the Hill House. And I went over, and Koshy, Menon, and Reber were sitting in the living room just chatting away. And I introduced myself, and Koshy, nice to know you, where are you from, background, a little small talk, you know. Reber, his first question was, are you hungry? and I said, I ate it down at Richwood or someplace on the way up. He said, well, let's get something to eat. So he goes over and the kitchen door was locked. Virginia Irvin was our cook. That was a love-hate relationship if I ever saw one. I mean, he loved to eat and he hated Virginia Irvin. So he goes over and he picked the lock on the kitchen door and went in and fixed himself something. I didn't. I may have eaten a piece of pie or something like that. So I got to know him very well, and we had a pool table John Findlay had bought someplace and put in the side room. And Groat was growing beans or something, so putting a reverse twist on them or something. And he was always stealing Harry Woodell's postage scales, which infuriated Harry. Because he'd weigh a bean or something. But he, in the middle of the pool table, he had about 2 bushels of beans piled up there, and we couldn't shoot any pool or something. Findlay got all mad at him and took his beans and put them on a blanket or something and dragged them into another room. But he was doing things like, and Virginia Irvin, his capacitors, he made his own capacitors. And you have to bake them in the, hot, something hot. And so he would go into the kitchen, and he would have his capacitors laid out on a cookie sheet, baking in the oven, and a sign, do not touch, or something like that. Virginia Irvin, she just infuriated that. So he was one of our great characters.
Was he actually on the payroll?
He was on our payroll, but they reimbursed
Research Corporation
and reimbursed us every month. We sent them a bill.
Uh-huh.
They reimbursed us 100%.
So why was it done that way?
They wanted to do it that
no.
way.
Oh, because they didn't employ people, I guess.
I guess
that's
not.
That's right, yeah.
I guess not. That's the way I wanted to do sort of the VLBA antennas, you know, work that out with one of the universities. But that's a different story.
That's being discussed again now.
What? The way it's...
It was just a meeting at the NSF last week, or week before.
Well, the NSF liked that, too, because they like to have the university involved in that.
Yeah. Oh, they still do.
Yeah, well, that was my idea. I would have preferred that. I'd just say, well, okay, we send them a check once a month or once a quarter or whatever. And that's the way Research Corporation, we worked with Reber.
So what did he do beside beans?
Well, I don't know that he did anything of observing or anything like that on the telescope. We brought his old antenna, antenna down, and he scoured the countryside finding parts for it, and finally got what he needed, and we erected it out at the front. I guess it's still in the same place, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It
should be. Still there.
Well, a lot of it's not original, as I understand.
No.
Because the wood had rotted.
Yeah, well, Jamie Sheets took him around all over the place, and he needed a Model T differential, I guess it was. It's not the transmission, it's a differential, I believe, that drives the thing. Well, anyway, Jamie said, well, down on Route 92, there's an old farm back in there that we maybe. Do you hear that story?
No.
So, got a GSA car, and Jamie's driving Groat. Take him down to this place, drive back in. Yeah, junk all just scattered all over the place. One thing was a still. Moonshine still. And here this government car, GSA, on the side of it, you know. So Jamie said, well, I had some second thoughts about it. The Groat got out, and he was looking at that still, you know. The old guy comes out, and he had a shotgun in his arm. So Jamie knew the guy, and he goes up and explained to him what it was. They were looking for a Ford differential for a radio telescope. Well, the guy hardly blamed Jamie, because Groat had gotten so interested in this still. It was just something of interest to him. Anyway, they finally found the differential for that thing. And now he did, he was fiddling around with something all the time. I know once he took a car over to, what was it? Took a car to Elkins and then caught a ride back to the observatory and left the car in Elkins. We had to send two guys over to get the car then. little thing like that. No big deal.
You told me once about when Heeshan was appointed director by Robbie. You went with him and...
Yeah, that got to be one of the little messy times. Not messy times, but it's confusing times for a lot of the people around there. Robbie became acting director after Struble left. I think, or maybe after Reynolds, I don't recall which.
President.
Huh?
President?
President.
Oh, president.
Yeah. And they had named Joe Pawsey. He had been appointed director to replace Struve. And Dave was sort of the acting director, I think, during that period, scientific staff, anyway. And Findlay was deputy director, and so Findlay handling a lot of the administrative stuff that was going on. And, of course, you know, the Joe Pawsey story, it didn't work out. So they'd looked around, been hunting for an astronomer to head up the observatory. And So the executive committee met. The offices were still in New York at the Columbus Circle, AUI offices. And Findlay and Callender were invited to come up to the executive committee meeting. Well, everybody knew what it was for. It was to want to get the directorship set up. And I think most everybody, including Heeshan, thought, well, they've named Findlay as being deputy director. He would be named the director. And so they got the train up, Dave and John. They were getting along they were very good friends and worked well together back then. And they got up there and they met and so forth.
Let me say, who's we know? First you said it was just John and Callender, but you were there and Dave?
I didn't go. No, just John and Dave went to that meeting in New York at that time. And so we were waiting, you know, figured, well, Findlay will come back, he'll be the director, and that'll be it. The 300-footer was well on the way, you know, and so forth, so Findlay could work in that. And stories I heard afterwards, Robbie said, well, we've decided it's going to be Heeshan as the director. And said, people tell me that Findlay is just like hitting between the eyes with a 2x4 or something, because he expected more than him. And Dave did too. And Dave told me later that he thought they'd name Findlay. So they came back. Dave said it was a long trip back for those guys on the train, you know. And of course, people called and told us what had happened. And we knew when they came back. John was, after that, it was his relationship with Heeshan, and certainly with Robbie, the words that he used to describe Robbie, you don't repeat in mixed company, you know, he hated the man, he was no good, and I said, John, he won a Nobel Prize for crying out loud, somebody thought he had something on the ball, and but at any rate, things were a little bit.
Do we know anything why it chose Heeshan?
Did you see anything?
I think Robbie had a liking for Heeshan early on, and Heeshan had the first degree in radio astronomy in the United States, I think.
Probably, yeah.
And Findlay, and later Findlay and I was talking, and he couldn't understand why he wasn't. I assume they want a guy that really is an astronomer after his name.
And what about an American?
Well, I don't think that...
Because the first time around, they certainly... because they had already decided on Poisey, so I guess that wasn't... But the first time around, that was very important.
Well, they wanted a name, and Struve was a big name. Yeah. And hell, his father and grandfathers and all that in Russia, you know. And so I think there was some politics involved in that, maybe, but I don't know. But I don't know that ever came up. It could have been, now. I hadn't thought of that.
Well, but that can't be too important, because they already offered it to Poisey, who was...
Yeah. But later on it might have been. I mean, I think Dave had a...
Well, it wasn't later on. It was only a few months later.
Well, that's right, yeah. And so... That was a little tense time there on that, and so Dave immediately, I don't know if it was the first thing he did or not, but he called me in and said he wanted me to take over the whole of the business set up, so making an assistant director, I think, at that time. And I said, well, okay, I said, after something. Talking back to one of them. What are we going to do? I said, we'll get together from time to time. We'll talk about this. He said, I don't want to talk to you at all. He said, you know more about the stuff that you're supposed to be doing than I know. He said, just don't screw it up, you know, or something like that. So, worked out pretty well on that one. Dave was pushing interferometer for completion at that time. Findlay was back to LFST because the 300 footer was about ready to go into operation. And so we had these two competing systems, VLA, which was an outgrowth of the interferometer, and LFST, an outgrowth of the 300-foot telescope, which was still in the back of a lot of people's mind. And, of course, not being the director, guess which one won out, you know, and I think that didn't help that situation between Findlay and Callender, or Findlay and Haitian. But anyway, things worked. Then it was about that, well, I guess 64, the decision to move to Charlottesville came to be, and things between Haitian and Robbie got strained all anew, if you please. And that's a different story, of course, altogether, but a continuation of the saga of the NREO.
So what about the move? I mean, when did you...
I was...
Who initiated it? Haitian.
I knew... There was mumblings amongst some of the staff members and their wives, you know, children going to the school up there and so forth. Schools weren't that bad.
No.
But the perception that people had, you know, let's get back into the big city and things like that. But I did paid little attention to it. I lived over at Cass, and things going along pretty good. And to be honest with you, I was thinking another year or two, and then I was going to probably look for someplace else going into my career.
Right.
And but one morning, Dave called a meeting of his top guys, I guess you'd say, Findlay, Callender, whether Drake, I don't know if Drake was there then or not.
Probably was.
Me, Bill Pleasant, remember him. Maybe Hayne. I think Cam Wade. And that was sort of in that one room where he had his, where your office was. I made it into a conference room. You guys took it back over to the office. And, they sat down, and what am I having this meeting for? He says, I want to assign jobs for people to look into moving to Charlottesville. The first thought went through my mind, okay, now Eloise must have got to him last night or something, because he had never...
Do you remember when this was?
Oh, I'd been late 63... I guess early 64, maybe.
No, it was before that.
Was it before that?
But okay. Because I visited in must have been July or August of 63.
Okay. All right.
Because I was going to Australia, and I knew I'd need a job when I came back. And he told me then. But I think it was pretty definite.
Okay.
The decision had been made already.
Yeah, well, they had signed me to look at the financial stuff, contact the University of Virginia, the controller over here, not controller, it was a guy named Vincent Shea, who was vice president or something or other. Dave is talking to a couple of people, I can't remember exactly who now. They wanted us really over here. So I went through that. Findlay had something about the local stuff, you know, living conditions, and Hayne contacts with the electronicers and that kind of stuff.
So the question was looking into Charlottesville, not looking into where to go.
That's right.
And comparing different places.
No, definitely Charlottesville. Well, so that, started putting our stuff together, and then Dave started calling the meetings. And Manny Peori was named to Robbie, I guess, to chair a committee of trustees to look into this thing. Well, Peoria, he had no vested interest in it, so he'd do whatever, you know, whichever way the wind was blowing. He said, yeah, you can move over there. It's a pretty good idea. It's a good university and so forth. Well, we had a meeting, I think it was it could have been at Brookhaven, and Robbie was not president then because things had evolved. It was before Keith Glennon, but Ted Wright was the president then from Cornell. And Robbie, he asked, well, why do you want to move to the University of Virginia? You know, and he said, well, it's a good university. It's proximity to Green Bank and this, that, and the other. Robbie says, well, you're building an airstrip. He said, you can fly, and the first time I'd heard Princeton mentioned, he said, you can fly from Princeton to Green Bank quicker than you can drive from Charlottesville to Green Bank. He said, if you want to go to a center of excellence, you don't go to the University of Virginia. You go to Princeton or some place. Yeah, Princeton, he kept running that. Well, a fellow named Carl Chambers, who was a trustee from University of Pennsylvania, I believe, he said, well, politically, he said, we may be, have some problems here. Have you looked at other places like West Virginia University?
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, Morgantown.
Yeah, and he said, and then a little university down in Huntington, Marshall. And I applauded because my school, you know, that turned everybody on the hill. And so we did. Some of us went over. I didn't. Some of them went over to Morgantown, looked it over. I think Mort may have been involved in that. I'm almost sure he was. And because they didn't have an astronomy department or anything like that. Anyway, the conversation went on, and Dave was so tied to UVA that there was no way he was going to get off of that. And the Robbie and Heeshan to and froing at that meeting got pretty, I was a little bit anxious on that. And finally Dave said, well, we either move to Charlottesville or you can get a new director.
That was, he pulled that line from time
to
time.
Well, Robbie stood up, turned and walked out, and someone said they heard Robbie say, I didn't, that somebody should take him up on that. Walked out. He walked out of the meeting. And Peoria was at that meeting, I remember that. And so they recommended, for whatever reason, that we moved to Charlottesville. So then the wheels went into motion. I got more involved because of the legal stuff, getting a lease for this land, and how do you build the building. And oh, we had $600,000 appropriated for a new lab in Green Bank. And so I called Rosenthal and said, we want to give you that money back because we don't know how we're going to finance the building over here. And, well, that tickled them. That gave us a few points with the NSF. So in talking with Vincent Shea and Larry Frederick, I think, we decided the university would build a building to our specification, not to exceed a certain amount of money, $600,000, which is what we'd given back then. And we'd pay for it over a period of about 5 years or whatever it was, at an interest rate or whatever their endowment was bringing in at the time. And the NSF liked that because the interest rate helped the university a little bit, and they were anxious to do that. And Bill Pleasance, he was head of our engineering division, I believe, at Green Bank. There's a story on that one in a minute. He hired Tibbetts, Abbott, McCarthy, and Stratton Tams to design this building for us. Well, we found out that they were not license to do business in Virginia, and so we had to get another firm here in Charlottesville to work with TAMS, and Bill did that. Got the lease, made the lease, and we had a very favorable lease, I think. Got our own parking, and I think they still.
That's right. Oh, that's right.
That was a good. That was still a deal.
It's, oh, it is. It is. Yeah.
Yeah. And and then I don't know what happened. Bill Pleasance, I said a minute ago that this, he's going to be involved. I was pretty sure that he was going to be the site manager at Green Bank. And
after people left.
After the move was made. And I don't know what happened, but he left. I think it had something. He got a better offer, maybe it was TAMS, to come back with them. And so I was head of the business and non-scientific and technical stuff. So I signed Tom Williams, who was the engineer, to be the inspector and work with the engineers on this building, because I didn't know anything about that stuff, so leaved it up to Tom. And sent Sydney over every once in a while to check out, so is the concrete the right spec or something like that.
That's Sydney Smith.
Yeah.
Just want to get on the record.
Yeah. So that's pretty much what happened. And it was about several years later, sometime later, Robbie and Heeshan, Robbie didn't speak to Heeshan for some time.
That's what Dave told us, yeah.
But I remember when the change came about, when they got back together. There was some outfit was giving Jerry Tape an honorarium at the Army-Navy Club in Washington. And I was invited, most of the trustees were invited, I think, or a lot of people invited, Heeshan. I think Eloise went with Heeshan to that. And I was staying at the Embassy Row Hotel. It was about 4 blocks from where the Army-Navy Club. As I came out of the Army-Navy Club, Robbie was standing there like waiting for a taxi or something. And he always called me Ted. And somebody said, "Hey, you know Robbie." He said, "Why did he call you Ted?" I said, "He doesn't know my last name, probably, but Ted's an easy one to remember." You know? And remember Bob Serber? Bob Serber? Well, he worked with Robbie at Rad Lab, the old Rad Lab.
Oh, you heard the name, yes.
He did the calculations for how big the blast was going to be.
That's right. Yeah, of course, right.
Well, he came up, and Robbie said, "Ted, you're going to the Army Navy?" Yeah. He said, "Well, get us a cab." I said, "Well, I was going to walk." And he said, "I think Robbie maybe had a cane." He said, "Well, I'm obviously not going to walk." So I got a cab. So I got a cab and we went down. And inside, and Dave, I'm sure Eloise, I think, was over there. And we walked in, and I went over and said hello to Jerry and Joey, and looked around. And there was Robbie who was talking to Dixon. And that was years, it seemed like years after that. But after that, Dave became his fair-haired boy again, and particularly when the VLA panned out. I know he was quite pleased with the way things worked then. So at any rate, that was the story there. It was a little bit
dicey. I only met him once. I was visiting my parents in Long Island, and he was coming down here for a meeting or something. And somehow I managed to find out and get a plane ride. I had to go out to Brookhaven.
You're on the AUI plane?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not, where do they fly? Stone?
Iceland.
Iceland, right. Yeah. And I remember that. He was quite impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, he was... He was interesting, interesting character. So, well, he was, as I say, I got to know him. Just to say we were friends is an overstatement, you know. But I knew him, and he knew me. He recognized me in a crowd, I guess. But I was, we were Brookhaven at Berkner, you know, Berkner Hall. They had the breakfast set up for the trustees and things. So one morning I come down and had my tray and was walking by, and there was Robbie and Tape and somebody else. And I was going by, and he said, "Well, I'm dead. Come on and join us." And I interrupted his conversation. And as soon as I sat down, and he continued the conversation. And he said, and then talking to the other guys, he said, "Well, then," I said, "we'd better go see the president." And I said, "Well, now this is a big conversation." And he said, "So I told Oppenheimer we will talk to the president about this." And it was good. I'm in, it's a big company here. So I'm in history here. And so I don't think I said another word during. And another time, same, almost the same situation. Robbie was really raising Cain about the Defense Department, how badly they managed the you know, these toilet seats and things like that they were buying. And he's turned to me and he said, "How's the VLA coming along?" And I said, "Well, I'm doing pretty good." He said, "How did you manage to finance that thing?" And I said, "Well, we went to incremental financing, which the NSF had never heard of before, but it seems to be working out for us." And I said, "It looks like it's going to come in on right on the money." And he said, "I think we should turn the Defense Department purchasing over to the NRO." And he goes on, and he was really upset with that. But he was a character. There are a lot of characters that we've met.
I found in his papers in the Library of Congress a note from Jackie. He wrote to Jackie Kennedy when Kennedy died, and she wrote back.
Yeah. The first time I met him was in 1959 at Greenbank. We were working very hard to get the lab building down in the basement set up so the trustees could meet. It wasn't finished, so we had to put boards down so they could walk on because the tile wasn't all down. But it was, I wasn't invited to the trustees meeting, but I had to go to Marlinton. I suspected the bank when the meeting was going on. The banking back then wasn't at all like banking today. You had to go to the bank and sign papers if you did anything. But anyway, I thought, well, I'll have an early lunch and head to Marlinton while trustees and everybody having their lunch. And, you know, they set up in the cafeteria, you know, the tables and over here and so forth. So I'm sitting there waiting for my hamburger, and in walks this little elfin-like guy and he goes up and orders him something. And he said, "Could I get something to eat?" And I said, "Well, sure." And fixed him whatever it was. Anyway, he came over. And he looked around at all this set up there, and he didn't want to sit there, and he came over. He said, "Can I sit with you?" And I said, "Well, certainly." And so he sat down, didn't say another word, and I said, "Well, my name's Ted Reif." He said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "They said something about you and new employees or something over there." And I said, "You're a trustee?" He said, "Yeah, I'm Robbie." I said, "Well, is this meeting over?" He said, No. I just got hungry, and I decided to come over and give him something to eat." He walked out of the meeting. So I got to know him. That's when I first met him, I guess, the first time.
So after the move to Charlottesville, you were site director in Greenbank.
Yeah, I think it was...
So you didn't get the move.
No. 64 or early 65. Heshen had moved, of course, to Charlottesville, and he was coming back. And I knew that was going to be a drag on the people. And I was the assistant director for finance and administration, I call it whatever. And I guess it's 64 or 65, I don't remember.
65. That's when I came.
Okay. Dave, one day, he just came down to my office and closed the door, and usually he didn't like to look like anything secret was going on. He said, Ted Wright's coming down, flying in from Cornell tomorrow. And I said, oh? And I'd met Wright on a number of occasions, and he had been an FCC commissioner, or FAA commissioner, sorry. And he was interested in flying. He flew his own plane, or flew Cornell's plane, I guess. And he was interested in the way we were building the airstrip, particularly using the soil cement rather than concrete and so forth. I thought, well, he's coming down just to check that out and see. I said, oh, well, good. Good to see old Ted, you know. And he said, well, I said, they're giving me hell about how we're going to manage this place up here. And I said, well, a lot of people around here have been wondering about that, too. Wasn't expecting anything. He said, well, I got to name somebody to be the site manager. I said, good idea. He said, I'd like for you to take the job. And that was, I said, oh, hell. that really came as a surprise to me. I didn't, because Pleasance, Bill Pleasance had been before, and then I said, well, I don't know. I said, Dave, be honest with you, Claire and I have been talking about moving on someplace else. And he said, well, you better go talk to Claire. I said, because I think she and I always have already talked about something to that effect. I don't know. And I said, well, I don't know. I said, I better talk to her, though. I said, I don't want to start getting knots on my head as soon as I walk in the door. So at lunch, I went over and went home, and Claire and I talked about it. And he told me, that's when he told me I should move over to back to Green Bank. And his house, Birchall didn't want to sell it right away because it would start looking like we're closing
abandoning
everything
yep.
down. And he said, we'd fix it up for you and do whatever. So I came back and talked to today, and said, well, okay. And that was pretty much it. Except the next day, Reynolds did fly in, and Reynolds on his way in, he stopped in my office and said hello and walked on back. Whether Dave and he had any discussion up at that point or not, I don't know. But anyway, in a little while, 15, 20 minutes, Beatty came down and said, Dr. Heeshan wants come back to his office. And of course, I knew what it was. And so Dave then told Reynolds that, well, I've asked Ted to be site manager here. And Reynolds said, good move, Dave, good move. Says, now what I want you to do, says, you sit down and you write out exactly what his job is to be. And Dave is, well, that's been, what, about 50 years ago or so now. To this day, I've never seen him. He should never told me what to do or never wrote it. Did he ever for you? No.
My letter of appointment just said, it was very vague.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So, but he said, not you work it out. And he hated things like that. Yeah. Hain insisted one time when Dave was, you know, Hain always became acting director.
Right.
Dave was out. It wasn't automatic. The trustees had to, Dave had to plan it ahead of time.
Yeah,
so
send him a letter.
Hain sat down and said, give me a job description. What the hell am I supposed to do? Oh. Dave said, if you want a job description, write your own job description. And that was it. So
you mean as acting director? Or
yeah, as anything. You know, that's just the way Heeshan was. He didn't want to tell you that your job is just this, because he may want you to do that. And if he wanted you to do that, you better be prepared to do that.
Well, later on, I mean, here in Charlottesville, I had to do that a number of times, and it was Phyllis who told me what to do.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, at any rate, so that's how that came about that I would be site director or site manager. I did not use the term director. I was assistant director and site
right.
manager. I was a little bit concerned, and Dave and I talked about it that first day. I said, well, telescope operations, I said, I don't know anything about telescopes. Bill Howard was, of course, doing all the scheduling, so that was, Dave pointed out to me, he said, you don't have to worry about that. Fred Cruz, he said, whatever you do, work with Fred now, you continue. And the same thing with the electronics. So that eased my mind, sort of. I didn't have to do anything more than what. So worked all right for 3 years, I guess it was, 68. Finley came back from Arecibo. He went down for, I think, about a year. He was going to go for 2 years, but only stayed one. And Heeshan was concerned, well, what am I going to do with Finley when he comes back? And Dave had been hinting to me that he wanted me in Charlottesville, and how we were going to handle that, I don't know. Because with the 36-footer, Hayne and I, he called us, and I was traveling on that till we got it straightened up. And the VLA in 68, remember, it was really popping at that time. We thought we had it.
Hmm.
And so he told me that I'd be moving over. Well, when Findlay decided to come back, and Dave didn't know what to do with him, he didn't want a deputy director, particularly Findlay. So he said, well, Findlay can go to Green Bank and replace me as site manager. John, it didn't mind. So John thought I was going to stay in Green Bank, and then he would have his own little fiefdom up there. That's the way he looked at it. But at any rate, Dave told John that I was going to move to Green Bank. And John had the audacity to call Birchall and Ted Wright and say, why is he moving Wright over here? And they got irritated at John then. The director has the right to put his business guy wherever the hell he wants.
Well, also, you shouldn't be bypassing the director.
Well, that's right. Yeah, well, they had some real arguments. John came back from a week trip from Arecibo, and he and Dave stayed in his Dave's office, and it got pretty bloody in there. John wanted to be the project manager of the VLA, and no way Dave was going to tolerate that. And that was when we found out the Budget Bureau had put money,
yeah,
$65 million, I think, in for the VLA. And they told us they were going to put it in. Later on, they withdrew it, as you recall. So then I moved over to Charlottesville. And,
yeah, we'll have to come back to the VLA because that's a whole story in itself.
Yeah.
So it was 3 years?
You don't realize that. I traveled an awfully lot then. I recall when Dave called, or Hayne, I guess, called me and said, Dave wants to have a meeting with us, and I was in Green Bank. He said, come over tomorrow. So, and John had just announced that he was going to Arecibo. So that was 65?
Yeah, he was already there when I came or something. 65, yeah.
And Dave said, Hayne and I went in Dave's office, and he said, what's going on with with the 36-footer? He had no idea. And I said, I don't know. I thought there was a contract, but there wasn't. Callender and Findlay had worked together on that earlier on.
There's a contract with Roar.
With Roar.
Right.
Yeah. And they were working on a letter of intent, and they were actually machining on the dish out there, and Frank left a little right before that. Calendar went to the University of Hawaii, and so he told Hayne, says, all right, Hayne, you're the project manager of this, and he said, Ted, you do whatever you can to help him. He said, we got to get that thing straightened out, find out what the hell's going on. And so Hayne and I, we went to Chula Vista, and there was nobody working. Well, they were machining on the dish, and were having some problems when the machine would gouge in at certain times of the day and so forth. And I think they couldn't fit, they didn't know what the hell was going on. But nobody else was working on it, because Rohr was having all that trouble with BART, that Bay Area Rapid Transfer they were building.
Ooh.
So they just pulled everybody off. Bob Hall, everybody else was had gone to on that.
God.
But we were trying to figure out, okay, why that gouging was coming. I think some janitor came, it's the tides. You heard that story?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the tides would come in, such great pressure on the land, it raised that dish just a half a millimeter or something like that, and that thing gouged right in, and as soon as the tide goes out, back as smooth as everything. So they adjusted to that. So then we thought, I thought things, well, we're going, oh, I got the contract straightened out, and made them sign, had them sign the contract. And about several months later, Hayne called me. He said, he's called, said, there's no progress on the work. Says, we got to go out and meet with Rohr. We'll meet on the mountain at Kid Peak. So Hayne left from here. He went out maybe a day or two before I did, and I came along, and Hall and company was going to be up there. And driving out, here the dish was sitting down on the Indian reservation there with Pinkerton agents guarding
it. I remember that. I saw that.
Did you? And this is odd. I held them to take it on up on the mountain, you know, and they wouldn't have to have these Pinkerton agents. The Papago Indians have a habit of, like in West Virginia, like see a
it was
sign
quite a target.
Shoot at it. So they were guarding it, and it was pretty well protected, I'll say that for them. But anyway, we met up on the mountain, and there'd only been one guy working up there. They'd only had one, Junior Madden, remember him? And they were still, that Bay Area Rapid Transport was giving them fits, I guess, or maybe they'd gotten another big job, I don't know. Finally, it Hayne and Hall, they just came to the impasse, and I said, well, Bob, I said, there's one of two things you can do. I said, one, we can declare you guys in default because you're not progressing on the job like you should. I said, then you're going to have a hard time getting another government contract. Well, he didn't have that much power, but I might as well go ahead and flex whatever muscle I had. And I said, or we can take over the management of the job. You furnish all the labor, but we direct it here on the mountain. And Bob says, I don't know. And I said, well, you better know, because those are your alternatives. So he said, I got to make a phone call. So he went in and called Bert Raines, who was president of Rohr. And a few minutes, Bob came back out, and he said, all right, what the hell do you want? Raines saw that wouldn't be very good publicity for him, I guess. And so Hayne put John Hungerbueller in charge of the project. I don't know whether John was the best man for the job or not, but anyway, we sent Tony Hammett. He went out and he worked on the dome, you know, the rollers. They were always a horrible problem for us. And Sydney, he took care of all the civil engineering stuff. I got only involved tangentially on the, where I got to know Nick Mayall very nicely. We had to bring power in, going around the north side of the mountain, and then go over the crest to come down to where the telescope was. But you can't have open wires coming over the mountain, which makes sense, and so you had to dig a ditch and put conduit in. So I was out, had made the agreement with the power company to how they were going to put the poles in around the side. They'd do a helicopter and drop the poles in, you know, and then dig dig a ditch and then put us, I think we had three conduits that we wanted then. Well, I was talking with Jim Miller, who was my counterpart at Aura, or at
Kipi,
and Nick Mayall, they wanted to meet with me. And Nick said, Mayall said, he said, can we put some additional conduit in? He said, we may want to develop on the, down the mountains in the future. We don't want to have to dig up again. I said, no problem. How many do you want? He said, well, two. And he said, but we'll have to get to go to the foundation and get permission to do it. Well, he won't do that for her. And he said, because we didn't have to get permission from the foundation to write a contract. And if we had the money and it was a project. And he said, well, we want two conduit. And I said, well, I said, that PVC is not very expensive. I said, how much? Miller said, it would be about $2,000 or something like that. I said, well, the ditch is already open. I said, well, so I picked up the phone, called Bill Bolton or Aaron Rosenthal and told them, because we did say we would always inform the foundation. And I stuck to that very clearly. I didn't want to get them caught up in something. So I said, yeah, we want to put some extra conduit in on the in Kitt Peak up there. And told them the story, what was going on. Rosenthal or Bolton, whichever one it was, said, well, I think that's an excellent idea. He said, keep us informed. I hung up the phone, and I said, well, I'll call the guy and tell him to get the extra conduit. But Mayall, he was impressed. He said, we could never do something like that. He said, they out there, they would not, the NSF would not let them. They had a big different contract than what we had. They
what?
Had
do you know why? Or?
Yeah, they had some real troubles early on. That's when they brought Miller in from the University of California, and he was, they were, a couple of guys about to go to jail out there.
Over what?
Well, if you came in as a scientist, he liked your looks, he'd give you fringe benefits other than salary. They couldn't account for the monies came in up on the mountain and the cafeteria and things like that. Oh, they had some real, it got real nasty. And I can't remember the guy's name. They fired about three people there, and they brought Miller.
Miller?
Jim Miller. You didn't know him?
He was your counterpart.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I did, yeah.
And, well, even after he left, he and Leo Goldberg got a little tense between them. And I know I was out there, and Miller and I had been to lunch, or was going to lunch or something. Yeah. I don't know. We're walking down the hallway, and B.D. Lenz became B.D. Goldberg later on. She saw me from way down the hall. She came running out and hugged me, and I said, oh, I haven't seen you for years, and so forth. And Miller just turned around and walked off. And so B.D. and I, we had a small talk, the old days in Green Bank, you know. And I said, Jim, I'm a biggest friend of mine. I said, he said, that bitch. You know, I said, well, what's wrong? He was getting ready to sue Aura, and Aura was getting ready to sue him, and his resignation was in, and so forth. And it was just a mess.
But you went out there as a consultant or something once, didn't you?
Early on, yeah. Well, and Jeff Burbidge, he said, if you want to leave Green Bank, he offered me a job. Walter Roy Roberts offered me a job up at UCAR there when he was president up there. Now, he didn't offer, I take that back. Yeah. He said, if you ever want to leave Green Bank, so get in touch with us or something. They asked me to come out early on to look at some of those things that they were setting up there. Yeah, Burbidge, Mort and I, we go out, and Burbidge wouldn't say anything, but Mort was there. Mort was the director at that time. And after he, I don't know, later on, Burbidge and I got together.
Detroit.
I said, you're not going to have it. I said, as long as you have nothing but a bunch of astronomers on your board, it's going to be difficult. Yeah. And that's that weirdly really their problem.
So the 36-foot was funded entirely with internal funds?
No.
You did have to propose the NSF? Or?
No, we. Sort of the story was Frank Lowe, you remember, was Greenbank, and we had that old Nike mount, and he set it up, and then he went back to Arizona. And that sort of started all that going. And initially, we did have enough money out of our OOE. So that's why we started the 300 footers, by the way, too. And Dave wrote to the NSF and said, we'd like to build this telescope on Kitt Peak. And the NSF wrote back and said, fine. Says, now you get together with Kitt Peak or Aura and see what you can do. So Mayall and Kitt Peak people were very happy to have. But Dave told Findlay and me to go to the University of Chicago, where the Aura Board was meeting, and explain to them what it was all about. Findlay could explain the technical stuff, the telescope, the structure, and so forth. Any business arrangements, I would be there to do it. So we met at 9 o'clock, I guess it was 8 or 9 o'clock, at University of Chicago, where the Aura Board was meeting. And Mayall and Miller, they said, okay, we're going into executive session, so you guys have a cup of coffee or a donut or something, and we'll come out and call you when we need your information. 15 minutes, they came out. Boy, smiles all over their faces. We don't need you guys, as they voted unanimously. Get those guys out of here. Said they that's exciting science or something like that. So we came back, and I started looking for some money to get seed money, I guess you'd call it, to get the antennas started. Findlay had already talked with Rohr and Bob Hall and company to get the dish going. And so that's when, so we did put the seed money in, But there's a, there's a letter, it's certainly in my files, and I think it's in the director's file, that Callender wrote for Struve to the NSF. We wanted to cover all bases and get some blanket permissions, the thing. Could we use our OOE, other observing equipment, electronic money, to build small radio telescopes? And the reason for that, there's a 35-foot Hessian one had built up there. 30-foot or 35, 40-foot or something, down on the site.
Oh, right, sure.
Okay, you know the telescope. And Dave was doing some stuff, and he wanted to do that. And I didn't want to have to put a line item in for that. I said, hell, let's just do it. So Frank wrote the letter, and I guess it's John Wilson, who was a deputy director at the NSF, wrote the letter back to Struve saying, by all means, says, just let us know when you're going to do that. And boy, I kept that letter. Because when we started the 300-foot telescope, we didn't have any money. And so I quoted that letter. It said, that's the biggest telescope in the world. How do you justify that under this? Because the first $300,000, I think, for the 300-foot telescope, we got it out of our OOE budget. The foundation came up with the rest of it, which was only another $300,000 or something. It was about $600,000, the total price of that thing initially. So so we had that kind of relationship going with the foundation. They trusted us, and you know, we had two GAO audits as a pro forma thing here early on, and that was one of the reasons in Green Bay, very early on, this was 60 and 61, they were there for that. The 140-footer was a mess.
Yeah.
Arecibo was a mess financially, and the Navy thing over at Sugar Grove. And if there's science, and Sky and Telescope magazine had a picture of the front. Those three telescopes, half completed on it, said radio astronomy in trouble or something like that. You know. So we got ours straightened out, and so I guess because we did get it straightened out, or, people looked on us as, okay, these guys know how to run an observatory. And it was Hessian's personality, this the observatory was. He didn't. He wanted to be a visitor-oriented organization, and he wanted a small scientific staff of very good guys. You were one of the guys he always talked about as being a fair-haired boy or something like that. And, but he wanted it to be a pleasant place to do science. Now, he could get pretty testy with his staff sometimes, but overall, the things worked out pretty well, and he wanted a two or three top guy. He got Von Horner. You know, he thought that was a good move. Von Horner never observed, I don't think. What did he?
He did occultations.
That's right, he did.
He was the first observer on the 140-foot, actually.
That's right. That's
before exactly it was even finished.
Yeah, I forgot about
before that. It was handed over.
And so he wanted it just to be a pleasant place to work and to do science, and that's why when we had a union thing up there, Dave and I got in. Dave Hogg was the site manager at the time, and Hessian told me, he said, you've worked around this kind of stuff before, and he said, I don't think we want a union in here. He said it could become unpleasant, because Arecibo, they had gone through a lot of this stuff, and I called Frank Drake and got a lot of the information that they had on fighting the unions down there. And we're not anti-union. Hell, I came from the coal fields of West Virginia, and I know in the 30s, if there's anybody that needed a union, it was the coal miners. But our engineers and technicians and at Green Bay didn't need a union to protect them. So philosophically, the approach was to just have it a good, pleasant place. He didn't want it to become big. He didn't want the observatory to become real big. And I think if Hessian had been still the director when the 300-foot collapsed, the Green Bank may have closed. And after he saw that nothing going with the 140-foot telescope. He didn't want to spend extra money, and he wanted us to be a sort of a unit of something else. Just do science. That was all. He didn't want us to have tourists. He didn't like tourists.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Yeah. He hated tourists. I mean, they just get in his way. Those damn cars, you know, they interfere with the telescope.
But the culture changed with the VLA, though.
Yeah, it did.
Couldn't help but be big. That crossed the threshold.
Yeah, and he was, and so we operated. He didn't like floss. He was ashamed when a scientist from a university would come and would go into his office up here. He didn't, that big desk and all that. And he would often meet with people in other places. He didn't like that. It was, he was all self-conscious, I guess, is what it was. He wanted to prove to people any money that we had
well spent
went into the science. And the OOE budget, which we set that account up. Any money at the end of the year, budget time, went into that account. And that's how we could build the 300-footer, the 36 footer. Because once you got down the pike and you told the NSF, yeah, we can do this much of it, then they could do it by fiat almost. Just they didn't have to go for a line item to Congress to get it, because hell, these guys have already got it set up. And that was just the way he wanted to approach the thing. He didn't want flossy carpeting and stuff like that at all. And I remember the first, he refused to let anybody get business cards. That was came up because I'd ask him once.
Oh, that's why I never had one. I didn't realize.
Yeah. But the first time, the first business card is in. I was, Sandy and Hayne came up to my office one day and they said, we're going to do away with cabling on the VLA. We're going to go waveguide all along the side. I said, well, whoopee-doo, why are you talking to me? I said, it's going to cost more money. No, we're going to save money. And what you did, it was much cheaper. I said, oh, hey, that's good. Let me get my pencil out here. We'll put this. He said, well, we got a little bit of a problem. He says, the only place they build this stuff is in Japan. And I said, if that's the only place in the world you can get it, I said, the Commerce Department and NSF, usually they agree to let us go outside to Buy American to get that stuff. And I said, but it takes some time. And they said, well, that's just it. It says, we got to have a contract written within 4 or 5 weeks. I said, well, now that is fast. I said, I don't know how we can do that. I said, how come? He said, well, in Japan, this is the last run. They're never going to make it again. I said, well, why in the hell are we buying something that's becoming obsolete the minute you order it? They said, well, there's no alternative. And he said, I said, well, there's bound to be an alternative. He said, well, eventually it's going to be fiber optics. And I said, well, why don't we go for fiber optics right now? He said, well, there's only a 30-mile test run up in upstate New York right at that time. They don't know how to get around curves and all this stuff. I said, well, boy, it's 30 days. I said, well, I'll tell you. I said, I know just the guy, Jay Marymore. They'll put Jay on it. And that.
He was ready out of rail.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I said, you need an engineer with it. And I said, what we do, we get them over to Japan. We go to the NSF and the Commerce Department, see if we can't walk this stuff through, which Jay did. He got that through in about a week and a half or something like that. He knew this guy's up there. So Jay came up to me and he said, you know, I said, in Japan, I said, in business, the first thing you do, you stop swapping cards. I said, oh, hell. I said, all right, I'm going to make a real decision here. I may catch hell for it. Later on, but all right, we go ahead and get you some cards. And he and Pasternak, was that the engineer that went? No, it wasn't Pasternak. Was it? Anyway, one of the Sandy signed somebody to, and they went over, got everything going, brought it into San Francisco, inspected it, got it in, and saved us several million dollars, as I recall. And so that was a. That was one of our better moves. I'm going to have to be going here before too
long. Okay, let me just go back for a second to the 36 foot. Why was it sitting down at the bottom of the mountain? Why didn't they bring it up to the top?
I don't know.
Where it would have been on NSF government property?
Well, there are two stories that I got. One, the winds up there and any place they put it, they said it might, I said, that's it. No, they had said it was on its edge, you know, when they moved.
That's right.
And well, that seems silly. You can shield it some way. And the other one was, you know, they had a where you entered to go up the mountain there off of Route 84 or whatever that is. They had you have to go under something there. Of course,
you would have had to do it sooner or later anyway.
Sooner or later, you're going to have to do it. But they're paying these two Pinkerton guys 24 hours a day down there. And, yeah, that was I asked that same question, but nobody had a satisfactory answer. But there wasn't any space around where the construction was going on up there. And
right.
They didn't want to...
bring it to the top.
They didn't want a rock fly up and hit the surface, you know. But it was covered pretty well, as I recall. And, I've been rambling, and that's probably not the best way to...
No, I remember seeing it at the bottom of the mountain. Oh, yeah, we had... soon after I came, there was a one of these joint NRAO Kitt Peak exchanges meetings, and so we went up to the mountain. I remember seeing it. That would have been sometime, probably late 65 or 66.
Yeah. Well, we had joint meetings. They came to Green Bank once, too, and I remember Mayall. Well, this is really a sad story. I wanted to wind up on here. Nick, that's where I got to know Nick Mayall. And... yeah, I took him around the site, and we went downstairs, and we had our little photography shop, remember?
Oh, yeah.
In the basement.
Sure.
So I introduced him to Brown Castle. Well, Mayall thought, that's an interesting name, you know, Brown. So went upstairs in our purchasing department. I introduced him to French Beverage. Well, he was about to break up out there. We go down to the warehouse. Guess who the first guy introduced him to? Jack Daniels. We go back to the meeting. He was roaring when he told the story to all these people. I guess we went to lunch or something. He said, guess who I met today? Brown Castle, French Beverage, and Jack Daniels. Okay.
Okay, well, thanks, Ted. There's some more we should... talk about, like